Hello and welcome to the Cinema Clash. I'm Charlie Jewell of charliejewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl of chickflix.net.
Hannah, we're talking about five movies tonight, and they're all over the map. We're talking about a Marvel blockbuster, a film for the chronologically advanced.
Oh, come on, that's harsh.
A film based on classic Russian theater.
Uh-huh.
And a German film, which you made me watch because I wasn't going to do it.
But yeah,
we'll get to that. But first, let's show you the wine. Let's see if, I'd be shocked if you can figure this out.
La Fiera. It is a Montepulciano d'Abruzzo.
Montepulciano d'Abruzzo. La Fiera from Italy, meaning the fair. There's a carousel on it.
Uh-huh.
There's no way you would get it because you didn't see the movie. Show dogs is such high caliber that the kidnapped panda gets on the carousel and disappears out from underneath the bad guy's nose. Oh, where'd he go? He's on the carousel.
It seems like such a highbrow wine then for such a lowbrow movie.
I didn't pick the wine. I went into the wine store and my five-year-old picked it.
Well, then it is perfectly acceptable, you know, for a five-year-old to pick the wine that goes with Show Dogs, the animated flick that I... Was it animated?
No.
Oh,
a lot of CGI to make those mouths move.
But, I was like, didn't it have talking dogs?
It had talking dogs. Oh, man, it had talking dogs.
I can't wait to hear more about it.
Well, let's start with the biggest film of the week, and it's a sequel, Deadpool 2. A couple years ago, Deadpool came out of nowhere, blindsided the world with how funny it was and how it poked fun at itself. It poked fun at superhero films, at franchises, it's making fun of itself. And I wondered if after Deadpool, people, regular people, even Marvel fans, could go back to stuff like Black Panther or Doctor Strange and take it seriously. Because Deadpool tore it apart, limb from limb, but I had no need to worry because people went right back to the Avengers and Justice League.
Mm-hmm.
Deadpool 2 is in my opinion, it's just a lot more of the same. It's still hysterical, but it's missing that originality, that creativity that I had no idea was coming the first time I saw it, and now I know what to expect. Therefore, I think I enjoyed it a little bit less. I don't want to take it away from. I still enjoyed this one. I still laughed out loud. It was funny. I liked everything that was going on, but overall, I was less impressed.
Yeah, I agree. I felt the same way about it. To me, the R stood for redundant because I felt like, and Ryan Reynolds, but I felt like I had seen it all before. So it was missing that, the shock value humor that made that first one just an, oh my gosh, what did I just see? Ironically, a friend of mine saw this last night in Atlanta and he thought it was better than the first one. And that really shocked me because I disagree. I can't see how anyone could find the sequel to be better. I can see that it's a worthy sequel, but I don't think it's better because that first one just blew you out of the water with a what in the world. It was so just crazy to watch that first one. And this one is truly more of the same. It's the same kind of gags, the same breaking of that fourth wall with Deadpool character talking to the camera. But I know what your favorite part of this movie had to be.
I have no idea.
Didn't you? The fact that as soon as that teenager started talking.
Ricky Baker.
I was like, oh my gosh. Ricky Baker.
From The Hunt for the Wilder People, played by, he actually has a name. It's Julian Dennison. Yes. But Ricky Baker is the 14-year-old, I don't know, what you call him, victim, semi-protagonist of the film.
It's basically...
I was shocked to see him pop up.
Me too. My first thought was, that sounds just like the kid from Hunt for the Wilder People. And then I realized it was. And then I thought, oh, it's going to give Charlie one more opportunity to do his little Ricky Baker impersonation.
Best happy birthday song ever. if you haven't seen it, YouTube birthday song from Hunt for the Wilder People, and you'll want people to sing that way on your birthday. I think I know where your Atlanta friend is coming from. Deadpool, number one, it's just about Deadpool, about Wade Wilson, trying to figure out his superpowers, that he can't die, that whole thing. This one has a lot of characters, and many of them are on screen for like 30 seconds before they perish in a funny way. I didn't know this going in, but he's putting together another franchise, which he's also mocking at the same time. You know, he mocks the Avengers. He calls Cable, played by Josh Brolin, Thanos, because he was just in Infinity War, and apparently they're putting together something called X-Force, and that's going to require a supporting cast of characters. And there's a long bit in the film about the first X-Force and what happens to them.
It is funny, and I mean, he's wearing like this X-Men trainee t-shirt, and it's funny, and so I think it's almost a light... The first one was weirder and darker, I think. This one was slightly more entertaining, perhaps, and maybe that's why it makes it somewhat better for some folks in terms of liking it more than the first one. But it's just that it is something you've kind of seen before, and I think for me the issue was that it came out so close to Avengers Infinity War, and so many folks are still processing that film and how that film ends. And I wasn't ready to just sort of turn over the superhero genre to this mocking of the Avengers and of that whole, of just the way that those characters play out. And this one, I think, actually moves a little closer to a standard superhero film. So even though it's got that shocking, sarcastic, self-deprecating element to it, it veers towards some of the same things that you would see in a more standard superhero Avengers movie in terms of, you know, they're trying to save this kid from an evil time-traveling mutant. And so it actually does have a little heart that's beating in that movie somewhere. And, it's entertaining, but I wish that there had been a larger gap of time between this film and Infinity War. Everyone's going to see it. I mean, we're not, you know, no matter what, it's kind of critic proof at this point because it will do well. But I did not like seeing Josh Brolin within 2 weeks playing essentially like kind of villains in an Avengers movie and then as a different character in the Deadpool 2 movie.
That is an off-putting back-to-back character selection. He plays them both very well.
Yeah.
He's fine as Thanos. He's fine as Cable. But yeah, that's a very quick turnaround for audiences. It's directed by David Leitch. We most recently saw him adapt the Cold War graphic novel Atomic Blonde.
Oh, right.
Very strong female lead with Charlize Theron there.
Also very violent.
And you know how Deadpool credits make fun of credits? So this one, it says, directed by the guy who helped kill the dog in John Wick.
Yeah, it was hysterical. The credits are always great. I love the soundtrack. Anytime you can fit Air Supply into a film, that's a good thing.
And it's great, but every time like a significant, and they do that, every time a significant action scene starts, they get into like 80s soft rock.
Yeah.
And I knew it was coming, and it was great. I was happy when it showed up, and I knew it was going to be something sappy. Like, it turned out to be Air Supply. It could have been Foreigner. You know, but I knew it was coming.
Right. That's the big difference, is you did not know what was coming in Deadpool 1. You totally know what's coming in Deadpool 2. You still enjoy it, but you see it coming. So there's that predictability factor and less of a shock value.
Well, our next film we're going to talk about will not share an audience at all. It's called Counter-Programming, folks. While the kids and the grandkids and the great-grandkids in some cases for this film go see Deadpool 2, their parents, grandparents, and great-grandparents are going to go see something called Book Club. Hannah, what book are they reading in Book Club?
They are reading 50 Shades of Grey. Oh, so I think over the course of 3 months, they're reading the trilogy. And that's not such a big part of this film. So you don't need to have actually read 50 Shades to laugh at this movie. But it helps if you did, because there are certain elements, there's subtext there that you catch thematically if you have read the whole story of Christian Grey and Anastasia Steele. But this book, this movie, Book Club, is really about the four veteran actresses that form this book club. And that's why women of a certain age and others will absolutely flock to this film. But I disagree in terms of your counter-programming thought. I know people who like both Deadpool and a Marvel movie and actually also would like Book Club. So I think you're being a little presumptuous in terms of who can appreciate both of these films.
When, in 2013, a movie came out starring Vince Vaughn and Owen Wilson called The Internship. Well, they were competing for internship slots at Google. And it was funny because they were old. They're not tech savvy. They're not millennial. And it felt too late. It felt like 8 years too late. It wasn't funny anymore. I want to see where you come down on this. I think Book Club is too late. They're Why? Like 5 years too late.
Why?
Because 50 Shades is a book as, you know, people going, ooh, 50 Shades. That's about 5 years too late.
I don't know. I think, yeah, I mean, it definitely was a book club favorite several years ago. But I think if you, the whole idea of this film, and with, you've got Diane Keaton and Jane Fonda and Candace Bergen and Mary Steenburgen playing these lifelong friends who have this book club, and they've always veered towards intellectually stimulating material for their book club. And they're at a point in their lives where they are ready and looking to shake things up a little bit. And so this was a book that provides the metaphor for that, and that just is the gateway to the comedy and to triggering each of their individual storylines and character arcs. So I don't know what other book you wouldn't have this movie if you didn't. What other book would you put in Book Club for these women to play off each other?
Well, you're right. It's very background material how this 50 Shades. There's a couple scenes showing them feigning shock as they're reading it. Oh, I can't believe. Oh, da, da. But so this is a first-time director, Bill Holderman. A couple years ago, he adapted the book by Bill Bryson, A Walk in the Woods, mm-hmm. where we had Robert Redford going up the Appalachian.
Which I remember kind of was a little boring, if I remember correctly.
The book was much better.
Yeah.
He's actually a producer more than anything. He produced Robert Redford's like last four movies. But this is his first time behind the camera. And he had a challenge here. He had to take four characters, four strong female leads, mm-hmm. and make you feel that they have been best friends for 40 years, and he succeeds because of the casting.
Sure.
You probably, in the back of your mind, you think, well, of course, Diane Keaton and Mary Steenburgen and Candace Bergen and Jane Fonda have been in movies together before. Well, they haven't, actually, but you think they have because they were all big in the 70s. Mm-hmm. And the one that feels a little out of place is Jane Fonda. She's a little bit older than the other ones.
But she looks younger than half
she
the other ones.
She looks younger than
all of them.
Except maybe Diane Keaton, who's still pretty young looking. But
Mary Steenburgen, though, is the youngest of the bunch. And so she definitely came out.
I do believe that they were mm-hmm.
like college friends.
And they each have their obstacle. And you can kind of break it down as society is telling them, you're too old to have a life or to go out and get what you want. And the movie's saying, no, if you feel there's some juice left to squeeze, go out and get you some. And that mostly applies to Candace Bergen's character and a little bit to Diane Keaton. And each of them have their male counterpart that they have to overcome some obstacle by the end to get with. And some of them work better than others. Diane Keaton and Andy Garcia
work
very well together.
Yeah.
But Jane Fonda's character arc with Don Johnson has no conflict in it whatsoever and doesn't work very well at all.
And Craig T. Nelson with Mary Steenburgen, that one works pretty well.
Forced a little bit.
A little forced.
That's just about lack of communication.
This is still very much a formulaic, predictable comedy. So I think what sets it apart is just that casting of this really good ensemble of veteran actors that are just kind of fun to watch, and it's the dialogue can be pretty pithy when the women are together, and I do like that it's four very strong independent women. And so you've got Jane Fonda as a sort of very wealthy hotel owner who basically has, I don't think she's ever been married, she has this old flame of Don Johnson, and but has always wanted no strings attached kind of relationships. And so her character turn is a little abrupt. I don't know if I bought into that one quite as
she's
well.
She's the easiest to diagnose. She hides behind her success in business. She builds emotional walls, defense mechanisms. She can never be vulnerable. She is sex yes, love no, is her. Yeah. And Candace Bergen is sex and love no.
Right. But Candace Bergen is like this... She always seems to be playing a version of the same role. She plays it well, but I felt that she's a judge, but she seemed to me, she played the same character in, I think, one of your favorite films of all time, Sweet Home Alabama.
My God.
And and in Miss Congeniality. And so every time I see her as sort of this very strong, caustic sarcastic kind of woman. Her character has a very similar vibe going on. And so here, you know, she is this this hard-nosed judge who has been divorced for years and years and suddenly decides that she's going to take on the online dating scene. And so there's the usual gags that come along with that kind of storyline. Mary Steenburgen's relationship, you know, that's the more sort of, it's this stable marriage, but she's just trying to put some spice back into their marriage.
I wonder if 50 Shades could help with that.
And 50 Shades potentially helps with that, although she also looks for some other ways to help with that. And but I think that this film focuses mostly on the Diane Keaton character and her relationship. Here she's a widow who is living in this very nice home in, is it Santa Monica? Somewhere in California. And her grown-up daughter, her adult daughters live in Arizona, and they want her to move out to Arizona because they're like, you know, oh, you're getting older, and we've got built out the basement for you. And she's like, wait a minute, I'm not done living yet, you know. And I think a lot of people can relate to that. And that was, to me, the most interesting full story arc in this film. And her relationship with Andy Garcia, who plays this pilot that she just sort of serendipitously meets on the plane. That's where I think the whole 50 Shades thing comes into play, is that's the relationship that is sort of the fairy tale relationship that, you know, the main romantic thread of just having met this guy and this relationship just blossoming, and he's a really good guy. Again, you were right, no stakes, no drama in any of these particular relationships. But that was, to me, an interesting one to watch. And in some ways, the Andy Garcia character was very similar to what you might have found in the female role in some other movies, kind of turns that on its head, where he wants to have a relationship, and she's the one who's just not quite sure where she wants to go with it.
I have two side notes on Club. The first one is, this is the second time, the second film, where Mary Steenburgen has attracted police activity in a car while going after her husband's man business while he's driving. That happened to Steve Martin in Parenthood as well, so that's twice. A lot of gifted actresses don't get that kind of Oscar bait, you know, one time. And second, Don Johnson. His daughter, Dakota Johnson, was Anastasia Steele in her Altogether. And now here he is talking about 50 Shades, and that's kind of meta.
It is very meta, although this is PG-13, and so you really don't see much of Don Johnson at all comparatively to what you see of Dakota Johnson in 50 Shades. But
all right, we have effectively beat Book Club to death.
It's entertaining. In the end, it's a formulaic comedy that works for its veteran cast.
Is generic and episodic, and it doesn't work for all of us. But it's not for me.
It's not for you.
But you know what is? The Seagull, an adaptation from a world-famous play by Anton Chekhov from 1896.
1896.
So I read this play in college, and I bonded with it. I loved it. It's about unrequited love, and when you're, you know, a pretentious undergrad who's reading Chekhov, you're like, oh, this is it. This is the meaning. This is it right here, let me tell you. And I didn't realize how famous this play was. It's very famous. And it turns out it's a rite of passage for actors. It's always on, like, summer stock or whatever. Everyone has probably taken a turn at The Seagulls because there's some very juicy roles in here. And the reason the director got to make it, Michael Mayer, the filmmakers behind this are from Broadway. They've won Tonys. Michael Mayer won a Tony for directing Spring Awakening. He also directed Thoroughly Modern Millie and Hedwig and the Angry Inch.
Modern Millie.
And so the only reason he got to make this is because Annette Bening said, yes, I will play Irina. She said, I, of course, everyone wants to play Irina because she's this, you know, flashy actress who's got most of the lines in The Seagull. And once that happened, anyone else would have jumped on the picture. So they got Saoirse Ronan. They got Elizabeth Moss. I mean, take your pick. And Stephen
Brian Dennehy.
Well, not the biggest character.
Mayor Winningham.
But man, that's big St. Elmo's Fire flashback right there, by the way. Stephen Karam adapted it. Now, it, you know, it takes a certain caliber of person to adapt Anton Chekhov, and he just recently won a Tony for writing The Humans. So there's some firepower behind the filmmakers, and there's some firepower in the cast. So I really enjoyed this adaptation. A lot of, you know, it's hard to do. This is a stage play, but now the character, the camera gets to roam around and actually show you scenes going on at the same time, which you can't do on a stage. And even though everybody in this cast is famous and is a very accomplished actor or actress, the one person running circles around the rest of the cast and not in like the third or fourth biggest role, just knocking it out of the park, is Elizabeth Moss. She is annihilating them as Masha. It's not a throwaway part, but it's certainly not one of the big three. It's not even the biggest. It's the third biggest female role, and she's killing them straight up in the scene. She's opposite Annette Bening, and she's just dominating her. Elizabeth Moss is a force to be reckoned with.
Yeah, no, I remember some of her lines. She was really depressed all the time, and she sort of, some poor guy was in love with her and she didn't return his love because she was in love with someone else. And that's all I really remember from this movie.
Hence the movie, Unrequited Love Chain.
It was Unrequited Love Chain and a period drama that just bored me to death.
And
so
tell the truth. Did you watch the movie?
I did watch the movie.
The whole movie?
I fell asleep and woke up and continued to watch it.
Did you fall asleep for an hour?
No. I went back and picked it up where I had left off. But I am just not a fan of like these early 20th century period dramas that pretentious undergrads might really like, that I just probably wouldn't have liked it back in the day. And I still don't necessarily like this adaptation. I never read the Chekhov play. I really wasn't familiar with it, but I can see how it is one of those ones where these actors want the opportunity to play in it. And so they're all very good in their roles. I just did not care for this film. And I think it skews way arty. And so, yes, for the pretentious book clubbers out there, this is probably a better choice than Book Club. But for the people who prefer a lighter, comedic ensemble of good actors in something that's not going to put them to sleep, then Book Club is sort of serves that purpose.
I can't understand how anybody would fall asleep in this movie.
I don't see how.
I find that shocking.
I mean, it has gotten some phenomenal reviews, but I also think it was not. I think it's one of those ones that gets the much higher critical reviews versus the audience reaction to it.
It's got. It's also, if you're familiar at all with the Siegel, you might not recognize this very much. He changed the language. He made it contemporary. He bumped it up to not necessarily our time, but in our vernacular. This is not 1896 Russian. Okay, yeah. So this is actually words we would use. And it doesn't go from A to B. It's a flashback. It actually starts with Act 4 and then flashbacks to Act 1, Scene 1. And that was the idea of one of the producers, Tom Hulse. You know Tom Hulse as 1984's Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart with that laugh. And also Pinto from Animal House.
There's a diverse repertoire for you.
So Tom Hulse is a producer here, and he's like, you know what? I saw this performed once where they started with Act 4, Scene 1. And oh my God, what a good idea. Because you're already invested now with Constantine and Boris Trigorin. And talk about identity. When I read this as, you know, my pretentious undergrad self, I identified with Constantine. He's this wannabe writer who wants to blow up, you know, pretty much contemporary theater because it's all fake. It doesn't mean anything. You guys aren't deep. You're all shallow. It's like, oh, yeah, preach it, Constantine.
That's right. I can relate.
And now I identify with Boris Trigorin, the like 40-year-old guy who's accomplished and has got works published. And he's like, shut up, Constantine. Like, why don't you just pay your dues and leave me alone? You know, get a job, hippie.
Yeah, my problem is I just didn't care about any of these relationships. That's what turned me off about it, is that I wasn't invested. And that's why I kind of dozed off, and aside from the fact that I was just really tired.
Well, you didn't take it seriously because you started at like 11:30 at night.
I know.
That's such not a good
idea. My link was expiring and I had no choice. It was watch it then or not watch it at all. And it's just not my cup of tea. And so I know that it is absolutely,
you know why it's not your
cup of
tea? Because the seagull is a metaphor for Nina.
This is
what?
I just didn't
like
care.
The climactic line in the film is when Nina says, "I am the seagull." They're like, no, Anna's not gonna like this.
I know, exactly. You knew I wasn't gonna like it, but I think our friend Eileen, the, you know, people who watch like Masterpiece Theater and the
is for Masterpiece Theater
it
fans.
Is that's who it's for, and that's just not me. And so that's why we have all these different varieties of movies out, because if one thing doesn't float your boat, something else probably will. And also that's why we put ourselves through this exercise every week, is to make sure that that the right movies get seen by the right people who will actually most enjoy them.
Well, our next film is not the right movie, and it's not the right movie for anyone except five-year-olds, and it's called Show Dogs. And it's not because it has talking dogs in it. I'm okay with talking dogs. In fact, I already gave 4 stars to a movie this year that is all talking dogs. That's Isle of Dogs, by Wes Anderson. I was okay in the early 90s with Homeward Bound, The Incredible Journey. I'm okay with talking dogs. I'm not okay with terrible scripts that Oh my God, I don't even talk about it. Max the Rottweiler. He is voiced by Chris Ludacris Bridges. He is a police dog. He solves crimes. And he also talks in one-liner platitudes. If when he's chasing the bad guy, and the bad guy jumps over a fence, and he mocks the dog. Ha, dogs can't climb fences. And Max just undoes the latch. He goes, "I don't. You play defense, I play open fence." And that's the entire, that's all, that's, he says that like every single line. And the main human is Will Arnett. Will Arnett, Lego Batman himself, which has a very forced homage joke in this movie that doesn't work. He's the FBI agent, and they're working together as a team. Think Turner and Hooch, because they bring up that movie twice.
Okay.
And they go to Vegas because someone stole a baby panda, and they're going to steal the winner of this dog show. So Max's like, "I'm going to go undercover as a show dog," because he's just this, it's like it's Miss Congeniality for dogs. You know, this Rottweiler's not a show dog, but he's going to put face cream on, and he's going to get bikini waxed, and he's going to learn how to prance, and he's going to try to win this dog show to crack open the case. And it's just a terrible movie. And so I asked my five-year-old when it was over. I was sure he hated it. I was sure of it, because he didn't laugh, and he didn't quote any lines from it, which he usually does. And no, he says he loved it. Now, I don't know if he's saying that because he thinks he has to, but he loved this movie, and but he just didn't show it while we're watching it. And it's directed by Raja Gosnell. And this guy is cornering the market. He did Beverly Hills Chihuahua, 2 Scooby-Doos, 2 Smurfs. He also did like Big Mama's House Never Been Kissed. This guy's all over the map.
Yeah.
All over the map. I don't know why he's going back to these these talking animal films, which can be done correctly. Just not this one. This is really one of the worst films of the year.
It's been universally panned by all the critics that I know. But again, a five-year-old appreciating it, that's good. You know,
I think six and up will hate it then.
So maybe it's a very slim demographic. I missed this one and was not sorry.
Yeah, you didn't miss it.
And the funniest thing was I read that you know, in our little critics group, somebody had sent a message that they had overheard somebody say that you shouldn't be allowed to go see Solo, which is next week, that, you know, sort of that next big film that everyone's eager to see, if you weren't subjected, if you weren't forced to sit through Show Dogs to
show you. Jim Judy said it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's a very famous critic. And Travis Hobson says that's his, that's kind of his mantra. That's his slogan. You know, all you people come only. I only see you at Deadpool 2. I only see you at Solo. You need to pay your dues.
That's right.
And that means you get out there. You don't deserve Solo unless you get in there and see Show Dogs.
Well, my biggest regret is that when I miss some of these movies, I miss out on what could possibly be in my worst movies of the year list.
Oh, not even close.
And so it's really difficult to not be able to see it, to put that on there, because I can't imagine subjecting myself to going back to watching this just to put it on a worst movies of the year list.
They have a dog. It looks like he's on meth, but he's addicted to catnip. He's like, "Come on, man, just one more hit." You know, just like, what kid is going to understand that? But it's just a god awful film.
All right, I'll take your word for it.
All right, I did not. I was like, it's late. It was towards the end of the week, and it's like I'm movied out, and I don't want. I text you. I don't want to watch this movie, and you pretty much did what I usually do to you. Shut up, sit down, and watch the movie. So I watched Bye Bye Germany, Es war einmal in Deutschland, which is Once Upon a Time in Germany.
Ah, that is sehr gut.
And it's a very familiar setting to a film we already saw this year. What part, Hannah, of German history are we talking about in Bye Bye Germany?
We are talking immediately post-war Germany, so when all the Holocaust survivors are released and find their way back to various places. So I think it's takes place in 1946 Frankfurt, and I think the billing on the poster called it a post-war comedy with chutzpah. And so that really is what it is. It's very reminiscent, I would guess you would say, of the film 1945, but a much lighter approach.
Anything is lighter than 1945.
Anything's lighter than 1945. But both of these films take a very interesting angle that we don't see all that much of, which is, okay, the war's over. We see so many Holocaust films. And we know the tragedy and the trauma of seeing those, and something like Life is Beautiful. This one is basically taking that same idea that if you didn't laugh at certain things, you would just cry or die. And so the main character in this film is this guy who he's kind of like a successful, smooth-talking businessman type of guy who is trying to help himself and others who Holocaust survivors get back, earn some money so that they can all basically leave Germany and go to America and find a new life in America. But his character is really, I don't know, I just absolutely just sort of fell. He played this guy named David Berman, and you don't really know throughout this film what exactly is going on with him, because he's being interrogated by a U.S. military officer to basically find out whether he may have been kind of in cahoots with the Nazis, or if he had been a capo in one of these concentration camps, if he'd sold out his people. And you don't really know. You don't really know where this story is going to go and what his motivations were. But he's charming, and he's a very complex, layered character, and I found myself really growing with this movie. The first half of it, I was not thinking I was going to like it, and then by the end of the movie, it was I was pleasantly surprised.
Both Bye Bye Germany and 1945 are based on guilt. In 1945, they're walking through this rural Hungarian town, and the two Jews don't even speak, and the town tears itself apart over the guilt of what they feel they did when the Nazis first rolled through Hungary. Bye Bye Germany, they're selling linens to guilty Germans, and they're all saying, "Yeah, we did have it rough." It's like, "Oh well, glad you made it. I'll buy some linens." It's funny. I was laughing at some of their sales pitches. There's comedy there, and David Bergman. I knew I recognized him from somewhere. It's Moritz Bleibtreu, and I saw him in Das Experiment and Lola Rent. That's Run Lola Run.
Run Lola Run.
It's like, I know I've seen you before. And if this was American, just to tell you what kind of person he is, he'd be played by Clooney. It'd be like George Clooney in one of the Ocean's movies. It's like, okay, that's what we're doing there.
I also found him to have a very Clark Gable kind of appeal. So that's who and I think Clooney also sort of became like our modern day Clark Gable. And I agree, that's exactly who I think would probably play him well in a Americanized version of this.
Please go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was just thinking the woman who he sort of is.
I was just getting her.
Yeah, I'm trying to. Antje Trau.
She. Plays the American. She's actually German. Yeah. She plays the American.
Sarah Simon.
Special agent. And this is the part of the movie that didn't work for me. Didn't work because their conversation could have taken place. They could have cleared this all up in an hour and an afternoon. But he goes back successfully for like 12 days. And sometimes they talk for 4 minutes. And sometimes they talk for what seems like 4 hours. And his story actually isn't that long. And he could have cleared this up like that. And as a narrative, they had to play with this to keep the film going.
Yeah.
It was a narrative choice to break it up into pieces, and that didn't work.
Oh, see, I thought that worked fine, because that's the romance. That's the spark of where his charm and charisma are most displayed. And so if you took out that constant sort of going back into the play that's going on, the interactions that are going on between those two, there's an obvious attraction there, but there's resistance too to the attraction. And then you need time for that to build. And so that actually did work
but
for
me. But it doesn't work in the script because no, like, it wouldn't have gone down like that over so many successive meetings.
Oh, I think you're overthinking that part of it because that's the only way that you'd build that tension that you needed for the payoff.
It's not. It's so not believable.
Oh,
They would add one conversation from beginning to end. He said, this is how it happened, and that's it.
But then you wouldn't be able to
No, it doesn't work back. As a film, no, but...
But you wouldn't be able... Right, but it's integral to the way that the film is structured. And so if you pulled that out, the whole film collapses.
It would, but it's which is why it didn't work. It's completely unbelievable. That's not how that would go down.
I think it did work. So I really like this movie. And if, you know, for me to like a movie with subtitles and I liked it because I really did feel that he had this Clark Gable kind of appeal, and you didn't know what to think of him, and you have to sort of stick with it to discover, like, where his story goes. And the guilt is certainly a key, survivor's guilt, as much as you've got the idea of the guilt of on the German side of, oh, we're really sorry that we sort of looked the other way while all this stuff was going on, or we're complicit, so we're going to buy all your linens that are overpriced. But you had survivor's guilt among the people that had come back to Frankfurt and who really felt, why did we survive when all these other people didn't? And so there's guilt. Guilt is a main theme among both sets of people. And so I just thought it layered in a lot of really interesting things. And it's, you know, it's one of those arty movies that I actually did enjoy way more than The Seagull for me.
It's not an arty movie. It's arty. You think it's arty because it's just in a foreign language. It's actually a contemporary, current, yeah. It's a mainstream movie. It's not arty.
It's one of those ones that is, positioned as an art house film, but does have mainstream appeal. And
like
so
in Germany,
that's...
I bet this was more than mainstream. It's only arty here because, you know, it's not going to get that 4,000 screen release.
Exactly, but it's arty in the way that if you're going to try and find it, you actually have to sort of know your art house theaters.
Oh, if you're not in a major city, you're not going
to
find it.
But
you're right. It is a good film. I enjoyed this film, but I enjoyed 1945 on an order of magnitude more.
See, I found this one an easier watch than 1945. I think they're both. I put them on par, but just a different vibe, and this one was a more enjoyable watch to me. And when I compare
it,
it's light, but it has some heavy themes going on in there.
Yeah.
And so I like the way that it was able to bridge all of that. And to me, if I had to choose between the art house movies of The Seagull or Bye Bye Germany, Bye Bye Germany wins hands down for me.
Yeah, you didn't give Seagull. You had to watch that at like noon for you.
I don't think it would have mattered if I watched it at high noon or during tea. I don't think it would have mattered because I am just not a huge fan of period dramas. I never read Chekhov. It's just not for me. And so I think
Fine, Show Dogs is for you. I want you to go see Show Dogs.
I'm going to go see Show Dogs.
All right, to wrap up. Yeah, we start way back in the day. We started with the blockbuster sequel, Deadpool 2. It's still hysterical. You really should go see it because it's just an antidote to some of those superheroes who take themselves too seriously.
It's funny, but I really wish there had been more of a lead time or bridge time between Infinity War, Black Panther, all these other Marvel movies, and Deadpool. But yes, absolutely. It's fun. So there's no harm, no foul.
Do it for Ricky Baker.
Do it for Ricky Baker.
Book Club, which earlier today had a fresh tomato at 65, and I just checked, and it's going down. It's now rotten at 58.
Really?
Yeah, it's going down.
That's crazy.
It's not. Just know who you are. If you're like me, it's not for you.
No, and that's very true. So again, it's sort of, I make the point of The Seagull maybe being for you. For some people, and the book club being for others. I saw Life of the Party. I think that was during our off week where I'd actually seen that and didn't have a chance to talk about it. But that was a Melissa McCarthy comedy. And so I put book club very much on par with Life of the Party. So I kind of think if you liked one, you'd probably like the other. They're not great comedies, but they're solid and just fit the bill if that's what you're looking for.
I did like the sequel. It reminded me of when, after the Avengers, Joss Whedon took a group of his friends to his house and filmed Much Ado About Nothing. This is along that same line. Some very famous actors went off to the countryside for a weekend and made the sequel. Power to him.
I never really watched Downton Abbey, and so
I didn't watch Downton Abbey either.
Yeah, but I think this movie will probably appeal to the Downton Abbey crowd too. It's just not for me.
Show Dogs is a pile of trash and should never have been made.
Go see Isle of Dogs instead, I guess.
Go see Isle of Dogs.
Although the 5-year-olds will not like Isle of Dogs.
No, they won't. Bye Bye Germany. It's good. It's not. It's only arty because it's in German and in one theater. It's actually not an arty film, but it's good.
It's good.
All right, next week, a quick teaser. We're going to talk about the new Star Wars movie. Mm-hmm. I've seen it. Hannah has not.
I will see it on Monday at the National Air and Space Museum in IMAX, so I will be able to actually speak to it in all its full IMAX glory.
Ooh la la.
A space film at the Air and Space Museum. I think that's how it was really meant to be seen.
Put the quotes around space. It's green screen space.
Space.
All right. Thank you very much for listening to the Cinema Clash. I'm Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Buchdahl.
Thank you.
Take care.